Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to see such a large audience here for this year's Besterman Lecture. I'm Richie Robertson. I'm one of the directors of the Besterman Centre for the Enlightenment, along with Nicholas Cronk, and I have the pleasure of welcoming David Wootton, who is one of the most stimulating, interesting, and wide-ranging intellectual historians around. It took me a very long time to recite all David's achievements, so I shall be extremely selective. He is anniversary professor of history at the University of York. He began by writing about early modern atheism, a very difficult subject to research, because naturally atheists didn't publicise their views. But that led to his first book about Paolo Sarpi, the historian of the Council of Trent. He's done a great deal on the history of political thought, especially Hobbes. Most recently, he's got into the history of science and written a very fascinating and very eye-opening book called Bad Medicine, subtitled Doctors Doing Harm. He's written a biography of Galileo and, very recently, a huge book, an absolutely fascinating book on the scientific revolution called The Invention of Science, recently out in paperback, which I recommend as an absolutely fascinating read. And one shows that David knows far more about science and technology than most arts academics. His next book will be based on the Carlyle lectures, which he gave in Oxford, I think, 3 years ago. And some of the material from that book will be presented now under the title Adam Smith, Poverty and Famine. David, over to you.
Thank you very much. This is Parson Woodford. And on the 6th of March, 1795, he gathered for dinner with three guests and his niece. And they had a couple of boiled chicken and pig's face, very good peas soup, a boiled rump of beef, very fine, a prodigious fine, large and very fat cock turkey roasted, macaroni, batter custard pudding with jelly, apple fritters, tarts and raspberry puffs, dessert, baked apples, nice nonpareil, brandy cherries, and filberts. Mr. Custance, one of the guests, we are told, ate very heartily. There was plenty too to drink, wines, port, sherries, malt liquors, strong beer, bottled porter, and so on. And I'm going to be returning to Parson Woodford and his dinner as we go along. And you want to remember the year 1795. That's a contemporary cookbook. And of course, the food was not served as a series of separate courses. There was a big table with all these different dishes on it at once. Many of you will have realized that my title is an implicit reference to a famous book by Amartya Sen entitled Poverty and Famines, which appeared in 1981. And played an important part in winning him a Nobel Prize for Economics in 1998. Sen is perhaps most famous outside the world of development economics for having claimed that there has never been a famine in a democracy, a claim he made in 1991. Poverty and Famines, published a decade earlier, was directed against the view that what causes famines is simply and solely a shortage of food. Sen argued that famines could occur when there was plenty of food if a group within society lacked the ability to acquire that food by exchanging something, whether it's labor or money, for it. Famines were caused immediately by a failure of what he called exchange entitlements, not by a simple failure of food availability. Sen analyzed in particular the Bengal famine of 1943, which he had witnessed as a youngster, in which more than 2 million people died. And he argued that it was the result of a crisis, not of supply, but of demand. Sen thus argued that one could have, in the words of the great Irish leader Daniel O'Connell, speaking about the contemporary Irish famine in 1831, starvation in the midst of plenty. There's a big debate about whether Sen was right about the Bengal famine of 1943. I'm not going to go into that debate, and it doesn't matter for what I'm going to say. His broader argument is what I'm going to rely on. Starvation in the midst of plenty. You shouldn't be surprised then to learn that as Parson Woodford tucked into his dinner, The poor in his parish were on the point of starvation. They were being supplied with subsidized brown bread and bread and coal. It was a bitter winter and late spring were occasionally delivered free to them, paid for by collections in church on Sundays. In the first months of 1795, there were 72 bread riots in England, and this and the next year are years which some would want to call years of famine, though they are perhaps better described in the careful words of John Bosted as years of terrible shortages marked by pockets of starvation. How should we respond to the juxtaposition of Woodford's generous dinners and the near starvation of his parishioners? In 1935, his editor John Beresford remarked, "Fortunately for the poor, the fount of 18th century charity seems to have flowed with generous freedom, and bread and coal were given for many months. Squire Custance and Parson Woodford each subscribing £10 to the general collection." He describes the charitable stream as flowing freely on all and every occasion of distress. The great socialist historian Edward Thompson, on the other hand, took a more cynical view, remarking that Woodford, who suffered horribly from gout, had been crippled by an excess of rich food, but nevertheless did not flinch before his continuing duty to his own dinner. Thompson's comment comes in an essay which is perhaps even more famous than Sen's book, entitled The Moral Economy of the English Crowd in the 18th Century, and published in Past and Present in 1971, Thompson's essay argued that riots in the 18th century were not random or disorderly acts of violence. Bread riots were directed at performing the function previously performed by the magistrate of ensuring that grain, flour, and bread were brought to market and sold at a fair price. Rioters would often take over a baker's shop, sell the bread at a traditional price, and leave the money collected behind them when they left. Riots often resulted in interventions by the local establishment to subsidize or freely distribute bread. Hannah Moore wrote a poem discouraging riots. Her views are expressed by Jack Anvil, who resolves, "So I'll work the whole day, and on Sundays I'll seek at church how to bear all the wants of the week. The gentlefolks, too, will afford us supplies. They'll subscribe, and they'll give up their puddings and pies." Though, as we've seen, Parson Woodford had not given up his puddings and pies. Thompson's essay is famous for introducing the concept of a moral economy. Sen's book for introducing the concept of exchange entitlements. Both believe that hunger is a political problem, though Thompson's preferred solution is socialism's and Sen's is democracy. Both are concerned with the urgent need to redistribute resources to the poorest at times of crisis, whether that crisis originates in a failure of the harvest or in a failure of incomes to keep up with prices. This lecture addresses a topic on which Sen and Thompson would have been unable to agree. Thompson saw Adam Smith as summarizing and codifying a hard-faced and hard-hearted commitment to a laissez-faire approach to the grain market, which was to lead eventually to the arguments of Edmund Burke on the horrors of the Great Irish Famine of 1845 to 52, to what Michel Foucault called the policy of laissez-mourir. Sen has always emphasized the ways in which Smith was sympathetic to the needs of the poor, and since the 1990s, his co-author, to whom he is related by the accident of marriage, Emma Rothschild, has argued extensively that Smith, properly understood, was a radical rather than a conservative. At the end of 1795, that year again, Smith was invoked by those calling for a minimum wage as a solution to hunger at a time when the day's wages of a labourer would not buy a barley loaf being a great step down, of course, from a wheaten loaf. One passage in Smith was seized on both then and now. Smith said that when wages are regulated, it is to benefit employers, so that when occasionally one does find a regulation which benefits employees, it is always, he said, just and equitable. An example he gives is requiring wages to be paid in money, not goods. Payment in goods often involving cheating. Smith was not saying that any possible regulation of wages to benefit employees is a good thing, which is often what he's described as saying. He merely said that in the England of his day, where the ruling class, as we might put it, legislated for its own behalf, any legislation that you came across which favored the employees was remarkably just and equitable and extremely unusual. Despite the efforts of Rothschild, one can't find in Smith an argument for a legislated minimum wage. According to Rothschild, Only with the publication in 1800 of Edmund Burke's Thoughts and Details on Scarcity, originally written in 1795-6, again the same year, did a mistaken hardline free market reading of Smith become established. And the question of the relationship between Smith and Burke on the subject of famine is one to which I will be returning. The 19th century reading of Smith is, Rothschild has argued, a mistaken reading. Smith, like Senn and Thompson, would have had no difficulty in recognizing the need to intervene to break a famine. My topic is Adam Smith on poverty and famine, and my task is to choose between two views of Smith, one which sees him as a hard-hearted spokesperson for a market which unchecked allows the poor to starve in the midst of plenty, and the other which sees him as a defender of the poor, especially when faced with famine. Before we proceed, let me sketch in a bit of background. The most sophisticated economic theory before the publication of The Wealth of Nations in 1776 was that of the physiocrats, whom Smith refers to as the economists. The physiocrats had campaigned endlessly for a free trade in grain, and there had been a long process of liberalization of the grain trade in France, beginning in 1754. Prior to that, there had been restrictions on the movement of grain between provinces, imposed prices, and other extensive forms of interference with the market. In 1776, the French government abandoned the new free trade policies in the face of bad harvests and popular protests. A crucial attack on free trade was the publication of the Dialogues of Ferdinando Galliani in 1770, a work which had an immediate and extraordinary success and a profound cultural impact. It's from editing those dialogues by his friend Galliani that Diderot is supposed to have learned how to write dialogues himself. In England in Smith's day, there was a bounty on the export of corn in normal years, and this was intended to encourage production and thus provide a buffer in years of bad harvest. Within the country, there was, in principle, a complete free trade. This very brief summary introduces the following points. First, the question of whether there should be a free trade in grain was not a marginal issue. It was a central issue for the new political economy, the economy of the physiocrats, and Smith as a successor to them. Second, the question was a burning question when Smith was writing The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. The bad harvest of 1774 was not only a crisis in France, where it led to the abandonment of physiocratic policies, but also in England, where there were food riots. Third, Smith was actively engaged with the subject when he was writing. He was not just repeating platitudes or views he'd formed in the past. Smith refers in The Wealth of Nations to a French book published in 1775 in defense of free trade. And he had in his library another book published in November of 1774, although it bears the date 1770 had been held up by the censors until November 1774, a reply to Galliani. Although there is no evidence that Smith read Galliani himself, he certainly responds to the arguments of Galliani in The Wealth of Nations. Thus, the corn trade was very much on Smith's mind when he wrote the book, and on the minds of his first readers when they read it. Smith's discussion of the subject is entitled A Digression Concerning the Corn Trade and Corn Laws. Calling the discussion a digression signaled his distance from the physiocrats, for whom the topic lay at the core of their whole intellectual system. But in policy terms, Smith's views were identical with those of the physiocrats, and he would have expected this to be evident to every informed reader. Now, there are several difficulties in trying to understand how to interpret Smith's view of famine, but the first is straightforward. Smith believed all famines are made by governments. He believed, and I quote, "In an extensive corn country, between all the different parts of which there is a free commerce and communication, the scarcity occasioned by the most unfavorable seasons can never be so great as to produce a famine. And the scantiest crop, if managed with frugality and economy, will maintain through the year the same number of people that are commonly fed in a more affluent manner by one of moderate plenty." When Smith talks about corn, he presumably means, in the first place, wheat, but also oats and barley. Oats were corn in Scotland and the north of England, because corn was the word used for the main grain crop in any region. Smith's claim is that harvest failure is never the cause of famine in any large country practicing free trade within its borders. even leaving aside the possibility of imports from abroad. Indeed, he says, a famine has never arisen from any other cause but the violence of government attempting by improper means to remedy the inconveniences of a dearth being a period of scarcity. You may notice there the emphasis on large countries as opposed to small ones. That was a concession to Galliani, who'd discussed at length what he thought the situation of Geneva was. And then having made an exception for small countries, Galliani had then applied the same exception to frontier provinces and then to provinces next to frontier provinces. And he'd run a slippery slope argument by which, in the end, every society was just like Geneva and every society needed to control its corn trade in the same way that Geneva did. Smith allows part of that argument and steps away from the slippery slope. We need to put Smith's claim that harvest failures never cause famines in context. First, Smith is talking about what he calls corn, not about rice or potatoes. He specifically says that rice may be an exception. And it was a well-established argument that in a country as diverse as England, a dry year will be good for the crops in some parts of the country, a wet year will be good for crops in another. Thus, the effects of the weather tend to balance out. Smith realized that this might not apply in rice-growing countries, and he had little interest in potatoes and was certainly not to know that they were much more prone to disease than grain crops, potato blight being the cause of the Great Irish Famine, and that stored potatoes, unlike grain, are destroyed by frost, as they were in Ireland in 1740. But his claim that harvest failures did not cause famines was basically sound. There was no occasion in Smith's lifetime when two back-to-back harvests were more than 20% below the average in yield, and an individual harvest falling more than 20% below the average only occurred once every 20 years or so. Over the previous centuries, the difference in yields between good years and bad years had been slowly and steadily diminishing. The weather was much less of a threat than it had once been, partly presumably because of improved agricultural techniques, and surely also because of increased dependence on the market had encouraged specialization, so that poor and unsuitable soil was no longer used to grow grain crops, but had been turned over to pasture. Moreover, both national and international markets had become steadily more integrated, ensuring that supplies were spread more efficiently across the globe. This extraordinary graph, using London as its reference point, shows how from 1740 through to 1795, the markets of the world moved towards each other in the price of grain. And then during the French Revolution, after 1795, they moved sharply apart. And then in the 19th century, they moved very rapidly towards, once you've got railways and you've got steamboats, very rapidly towards a common position. National and international markets have become steadily more integrated. The problem, of course, is that prices were much more volatile than supplies. Smith himself provides figures which show that the price of wheat tripled between 1706 and 1709, and halved between 1740 and 1743. So a 25% movement in supply led to a doubling or tripling of price. Smith massively underestimated the risk of famine within a free market economy. But one can see why he might be tempted to do so. One basic reason for his underestimating the risk was that there had been no significant famine in England for more than a century. But what are improper means, he said, I quote, the violence of government attempting by improper means to remedy the inconveniences of a dearth. Smith certainly had in mind the magistrate forcing merchants to bring grain to market or imposing a fair price upon them. Both measures would be bound to discourage new supplies being brought into a region or state where such measures were being imposed, and thus would have the opposite of the intended effect. Smith directly criticizes the bread riots described by Thompson. And one can see why he would hold that such interventions were liable within a market economy to be counterproductive. But Smith goes well beyond an attack on the old moral economy of the just price. He argues that the interest of the corn merchant and of the population are identical. He says, it is the corn merchant's interest to raise the price of corn as high as the real scarcity of the season requires, and it can never be his interest to raise it higher. By raising the price, he discourages the consumption and puts everybody, more or less, but particularly the inferior ranks of people, upon thrift and good management. In other words, according to Smith, the market price should always be accepted as if it were the right price. I say as if it were because he's very aware that the market price is often the wrong price. Doesn't matter. It's the only price that you should rely on. It is important to note that the whole of Smith's digression on the corn trade is directed at what we might call the old moral economy, which sought to set maximum prices and force corn merchants to bring corn to market. He makes no mention of what we might call the new moral economy, the moral economy of Parson Woodford, of subsidies and subscriptions, though this moral economy had been in existence at least since 1740. In 1757, one Bristol parish alone supplied 12,000 pounds of cheap bread to 700 families. In 1766, the city's merchant venturers purchased 6,000 bushels of wheat in Danzig to ensure supplies, while the principal gentleman of Norwich promised to raise 8,000 pounds to import corn from abroad. It's possible to drop a very long list of MPs who subscribed, usually 50 pounds or 100 pounds each, in 1766 to subsidize or distribute free bread, particularly MPs, because it was a way of buying the next election. It's essential here to distinguish between poor relief and the new moral economy. Legislation authorized local authorities to tax householders in order to pay for the relief of the unemployed and the unemployable. These taxes fell on the wealthy, but also on those with modest incomes, who could ill afford to pay them in years of high food prices. Subsidies and charitable distributions were quite different. They were funded by voluntary contributions and thus were not based on taxation and do not represent a form of state intervention. And they primarily benefited not those on poor relief, but those whose wages were too low for them to be able to afford bread. Smith discusses poor relief. He is critical of it because the poor have to be relieved in their home parish and are consequently prevented from moving in search of work. Smith was a great get-on-your-bicycle sort of person if the bicycle had existed at the time. On the subject of charity, however, Smith is mysteriously silent, and it's that silence that preoccupies me. Or rather, to be frank, Smith implies that charity is unnecessary. He compares the corn merchant to the master of a ship which is becalmed at sea, with supplies running low. The corn merchant, acting out of self-interest, happens to treat the people as, I quote, "the prudent master of a vessel is sometimes obliged to treat his crew. When he foresees that provisions are likely to run short, he puts them upon short allowance. Though from excessive caution, he should sometimes do this without any real necessity. Yet all the inconveniences which his crew can thereby suffer are inconsiderable in comparison of the danger, misery, and ruin to which they might sometimes be exposed by a less provident conduct. We should trust the corn merchant, not because he is deliberately acting to protect us from starvation, but because he is simply the agent of impersonal market forces, and the information in the market is superior to the information held by any individual." But of course, on a ship, rations can be handed out equally. In real life, there is no such equality. Smith distracts our attention from this basic fact by a sleight of hand. The corn merchant, he writes, by raising the price of corn, discourages the consumption and puts everybody, more or less, but particularly the inferior ranks of people, upon thrift and good management. In his example of the captain on his ship, all the crew, but presumably not all the officers, are treated the same. But of course, in real life, everyone isn't in the same boat. Some keep their jobs, others lose them. Some have friends and family to whom they can turn, others do not. Some have children to feed, others do not. Some have a cottage garden from which to supplement their diet, others do not. In the Burmese famine of 1943, the death toll among women was much higher than among men. In the Dutch hunger winter of 1944 to 1945, where every effort was made to equalize rations, as if the German-occupied Netherlands really were a ship at sea, it was the elderly men who died. Famine does not come for everybody, more or less. It comes hand in hand with disease. It takes away one person and it leaves another. Prices may be a form of rationing, but no form of rationing can be fair because the circumstances of human beings vary. Prices are a particularly unfair form of rationing because different people have different financial resources and other resources, such as market gardens. Now, Galliani understood this. In his dialogues, he has his spokesperson argue against someone who thinks as Smith does. "Ah, sir, I see that you do not yet know what a famine is. You think a famine is a universal catastrophe. You are mistaken. In a famine, everyone suffers as a result of a catastrophe which strikes individuals one by one. During a famine, the rich, the well-to-do, do not suffer, and grain merchants even benefit. But all shudder at the sight of the most dreadful spectacle. One sees people dying of hunger. The impact of this is powerful because it is a response to the sight of the most cruel suffering. The catastrophe of a famine strikes a small number, but empathy ensures that all suffer. Even the hardest hearts are touched. One single person dying of hunger in the street makes a whole town full of people who have dined well, sad, and throws them into a state of despair." Galliani understood perfectly well that people can be dying of hunger in a town where most people have dined well. Instead of there being rationing for all, for some there is life nearly as normal, for others death by starvation. Let us imagine for a moment that Smith had turned his mind to those who donated bread to the poor or subsidized the price of bread, those like Parson Woodford. One might think that their behavior could be compared to a petty officer going behind the prudent master's back and handing out extra rations. He might mean well, but he would not be helping. This, you might think, is precisely the less provident conduct that is liable to lead to danger, misery, and ruin. Arguments such as this were used to justify non-intervention in the 19th century. But Smith would not, I think, if he had thought about the matter, have reached this conclusion. For there is no prudent master in the market. It is the market which sets the price. So when charitable subscribers buy bread to distribute to the poor or subsidize bread, what they do is push up the price of bread in the market. The corn dealers, knowing how much they have in stock, will not allow their supplies to be used up all at once, but will raise the price until other purchasers drop out, buying less or giving up altogether. In other words, what the new political economy, the new moral economy does, what charity does, is spread the need for what Smith calls thrift and good management more widely. It makes rationing fairer. It reduces the pressure on the poorest and increases the pressure on the middling sort. The donations of people like Parson Woodford were not undermining the market's role in rationing supply. They were simply making the nation more like a ship in which rations were doled out equally. Smith ought to have welcomed that new moral economy. Moreover, in his chapter on wages, Smith had provided a very careful account of how in years of dearth, when food prices rise, wages do not rise to keep up, rather they fall. As food prices rise, expenditure on non-food items falls. People stop buying shoes and dresses and so on. Servants are laid off, craftsmen and shopkeepers lay off their employees, and eventually they go bust. As the numbers of unemployed grow, wages naturally fall. There's a quite straightforward scissors effect. As food prices rise, wages go down. What we are looking at here is precisely the sort of process analyzed by Amartya Sen, a failure of exchange entitlements. Is there a limit to this process? Smith says that in the end, the floor for wages is set by what he calls common humanity, a phrase he uses three times in the chapter on wages, but does not use anywhere else in any of his other writings. Employers want their workers to survive from one year to the next. But wages were set each year at Michaelmas, just after the main wheat harvest, and long before it was possible to predict how prices would move in the coming year. And Smith was well aware that masters in years of dearth drove as hard a bargain as they could. This is what he says. "Masters of all sorts, therefore, frequently make better bargains with their servants in dear than in cheap years, and find them more humble and dependent in the former than in the latter. The floor for wages is bound to be low and may quickly prove to be too low when prices start to rise." Now, common humanity is precisely what drove Parson Woodford's donations to the poor. Grants and subsidies were more attractive than raising wages, and not just because it might be difficult to lower wages once they had been raised. Shopkeepers, craftsmen, and small farmers could easily have been broken if they had been forced to pay higher wages, just as easily as if they had been forced to pay higher poor rates. Woodford, on the other hand, could easily afford his donations out of his vast income of £400 a year. Grants and subsidies had the same effect as higher wages, without, as higher wages would have done, forcing an increase in unemployment. They improved the exchange entitlements of the employed poor without reducing the number in employment. But precisely at the point where he invokes common humanity, Smith fails to ask how this humanity ought to express itself. He fails to discuss charity. He fails to discuss grants and subsidies. There was an alternative to grants and subsidies, and that was make work projects. During the disette, the dearth or famine of 1771 to 1773, the French economist Turgot, who was a free trader and had been appointed intendant of the Limousin, used government funds to feed the impotent poor. But the able-bodied poor, including women and children, he set to work on road building so that they could earn a living at a time when many were being thrown out of work. Emma Rothschild thinks that Smith would have approved such projects, although he never ever says that government should intervene to create jobs. There is no evidence that Smith would have thought this a proper means of remedying the problem of unemployment during a dearth. Such schemes paid out of taxation would have the same stifling consequences for economic activity as poor relief. Now, you may want to say now that I am wandering from the point. I persist in discussing famine, forgetting that Smith insists that it is interference with the market which causes famine. His central claim is that if there is no interference with the market, there will be no famine. Dearths cause what he gently calls inconveniences. Inconveniences which the people can suffer, he says, from high prices. They are not to be confused with famine. In the first place, Smith knew that this was to understate the problem. He knew that, as he puts it, years of dearth are generally among the common people years of sickness and mortality. He discussed how the children of the poor tend to die because their parents cannot feed them or care for them properly. In the Highlands of Scotland, he remarked, it is common for a woman to have 20 children, only two of whom survive to adulthood. Smith knew perfectly well that the greatest inconveniency of a dearth was the increased mortality amongst children and the old. Calling this an inconveniency is, I think, an abusive language, and it's important to recognize that what Smith calls a dearth borders on what others would call a famine. It's helpful here to compare Smith's language with that of Sir James Stuart, who was also a free trader and who published a decade before Smith. Stuart at least gave some thought to the inconveniences of a dearth. It is far from being true, he says, that the same number of people consume always the same quantity of food. In years of plenty, everyone is well fed. The price of the lowest industry can procure subsistence sufficient to bear a division. Food is not so frugally managed. A quantity of animals are fatted for use. All sorts of cattle are kept in good heart, and people drink more largely because all is cheap. A year of scarcity comes, the people are ill-fed, and when the lower classes come to divide with their children, the portions are brought to be very small. There is great economy upon consumption. Few animals are fatted for use. Cattle look miserably, and a poor man cannot indulge himself with a cup of generous ale. But Smith also knew, or should have known, that his cheerful claim that famine could be dismissed by political economists as the result of government meddling was open to dispute. In fact, it was simply false. In 1740 to 42, approximately 10% of the Irish population, some 300,000 people, died of famine and of famine-related disease. Deaths were heavily concentrated in Munster, where 20% may have died. This is a sort of Thompsonian tract. It's written by the populace of Dublin defending their insurrection against the grain traders and the bakers. But I want to quote from The Groans of Ireland. "Sir," the author says, "I have been absent from this country for some years, and on my return to it last summer found it the most miserable scene of universal distress that I have ever read of in history. Wanton misery in every face, the rich unable almost, as they were willing." I'm going to read that a second time because I don't know how to read it. "The rich unable almost, as they were willing, to relieve the poor." don't know if as there means if or what it means. The rich, unable almost as they were willing to relieve the poor. The roads spread with dead and dying bodies. Mankind of the colour of the docks and nettles which they are fed on. Two or three, sometimes more, on a car, going to the grave for want of bearers to carry them, and many buried only in the fields and ditches where they perished. This universal scarcity was ensued by fluxes and malignant fevers which swept off multitudes of all sorts. Whole villages were laid waste by want and sickness, and death in various shapes, and scarce an house in the whole island escaped from tears and mourning. Smith was surely aware of the desperate situation in Ireland caused by recurring famines, for he had on his bookshelves two sets of the complete works of Jonathan Swift, who has a good claim to being Smith's favourite contemporary author. He thus had two copies of Swift's Modest Proposal of 1729. 1729 was, of course, a famine year. I expect many of you are familiar with that work, in which, with its graphic account of how the poor of Ireland were so reduced to the utmost extremes of want that it would be sensible for them to sell their children as livestock to be butchered and eaten. Swift writes, "I have been assured by a very knowing American of my acquaintance in London that a young, healthy child, well nursed, is at a year old a most delicious, nourishing, and wholesome food, whether stewed, roasted, baked, or boiled." You can imagine the parson's meal, can't you? "And I make no doubt that it will equally serve in a fricassee or a ragout. A child will make two dishes at an entertainment for friends, and when the family dines alone, the fore, hindquarter, will make a reasonable dish, and seasoned with a little pepper or salt, will be very good boiled on the fourth day, especially in winter. I grant this food will be somewhat dear, and therefore very proper for landlords, who, as they have already devoured most of the parents, seem to have the best title to the children." Now, one thing is immediately apparent to a reader of The Modest Proposal and of accounts of the famines of 1720 to 21, 1728 to 29, and 1740 to 42. People did not starve in Ireland because there was no food. They starved because they could not pay for the food that was available in the markets. Swift's solution, after all, is not that they should be given food, but that they should be given an income through the sale of their children. And in the worst years of famine, relief was provided sometimes as soup, but also in the form of money or delayed collection of rents or make work schemes, in one case, the building of an enormous obelisk. Smith claims to have made a careful study of European famines over the last two centuries. I've searched around to find what he'd been reading. There is, I think, only one book that remotely fits the bill. It's not in his library, so we can't be sure, but I think it has to be this. Louis-Paul Abbé's Factors Which Have Made for High Grain Prices in France and England of 1768, a hardline free market tract. It's a very simple fact that all the tracts about the corn trade and famine in Smith's library are hardline free market tracts. It thus seems very likely that Smith's reading had been largely confined to the history of famine in England and France, and that he had made no careful study of Ireland. What, though, might he have said to explain Irish famines, particularly the devastating famine of 1740 to 42. Now, one might argue that Ireland was not an extensive corn country, but I can't see that argument being taken seriously because Ireland had excellent transport connections with England, and the English had no ban on the export of grain in those years, so that Ireland's size, large, small, or in between, however you want to classify it, would seem to be irrelevant. One might argue that the Irish famine was caused by government intervention, but there was virtually no government intervention. At one point, they finally banned the export of grain. That's all the government did. So why did the Irish starve? The modern answer is that a major factor was the absence of any institutionalized system of poor relief in Ireland. Absentee landlords were relatively uninterested in contributing to subscriptions. There were no communities gathered around the parish church, as in Parson Woodford's England. Smith himself emphasized the plight of the Irish, whose economy was misshapen as a result of their colonial relationship to England, and whose ruling class were particularly hard-hearted because of the religious differences that came between landlords and their tenants. He describes the relationship between Irish landlords and their tenants as grounded, I quote, "in the most odious of all distinctions, those of religious and political prejudices, distinctions which, more than any other, animate both the insolence of the oppressors and the hatred and indignation of the oppressed, and which commonly rendered the inhabitants of the same country more hostile to one another than those of different countries ever are. The best solution, Smith thought, for the situation of Ireland was a union with England and Scotland on the model of the Anglo-Scottish Union of 1707, which he believed had liberated the poor in Scotland from the oppression of their landlords as well. So here's the problem. Ireland in 1740 to 42 starved, not because of a bad harvest or two, but because of the insolent oppression of its English-speaking landlords, because of the absence of poor relief and of the new moral economy. England, on the other hand, in the dreadful famine years of 1795 to 96, avoided starvation very largely because it had poor relief and it had what I'm calling the new moral economy. Smith was wrong. The market alone was not a solution to the problem of famine, and if he had paid attention to Ireland, he would have seen that he was wrong. Of course, you might say, if the Irish had been fed, someone else would have had to go without. And since the Irish starved, someone else could be fed. The English in 1740 to 42 were busy subsidizing prices and making grants to the poor. A really hardline Smithian would surely argue that this may have saved English lives, but only at the expense of Irish lives, for grain which would otherwise have been available for export to Ireland remained in England. Smith himself recognizes that countries are bound to be competing amongst each other when supplies are limited. Arguably, relief in England did not actually work. It simply exported starvation from England to Ireland. It is the Irish who paid the price for English interference with the market. So too, one might want to argue, with regard to Turgot's make-work schemes in the Limousin, that the gains in one province must surely have been made at the expense of its neighbours, and if few starved in the Limousin, more must have starved elsewhere. That argument might have some merit. It's an unpleasant argument, but unpleasant arguments are sometimes true. It can't follow that Turgot or even Parson Woodford were at fault. They are surely not to blame for the inaction of others. And Smith was right, even in bad years, there was enough to go round if it was distributed fairly. In the course of this lecture, we have looked at three approaches to poverty, dearth, and famine. The exchange entitlements approach of Amartya Sen, where famine occurs when people are priced out of the market. The moral economy approach of Edward Thompson, where markets should be made subservient to the needs of the people. And the laissez-faire approach of Adam Smith's digression on the corn trade, where famines, we are assured, will never occur if the markets are allowed to operate unchecked. I have argued, I hope persuasively, that attempts to read Adam Smith as if he shared Sen's views are deeply implausible, for Smith had nothing to say about improving the exchange entitlements of the poor, though he understood exactly how in times of death, exchange entitlements of dearth, exchange entitlements are eroded and eliminated. Nevertheless, he failed even to mention the new moral economy of subsidies and subscriptions. He failed to ask himself why there were famines in Ireland. He failed to acknowledge the extent of the inconveniences suffered by the poor in years of dearth. Instead, when it came to the corn trade, he simply repeated the arguments of the physiocrats, although their policies had already failed in France. He never bothered to read, I think, the key attack on their arguments, Galliani's Dialogues. On the profoundly important subject of poverty and famine, I think there is no way of defending Smith for the simple reason that he failed to address the issue of starvation in the midst of plenty. He had to hand all the components of an exchange entitlement theory, but he failed to assemble those components and failed to acknowledge the inadequacy of the arguments of the physiocrats which he had inherited. Why? What went wrong? The key to answering this question, I think, is to compare Smith's digression with Edmund Burke's Thoughts on Scarcity, written during the crisis of 1795 to 6, with which I began this lecture, and published during the next subsistence crisis in 1800. Burke runs a straightforward free market argument, with one crucial exception. He acknowledges that the wages of laborers may sink so low that it becomes impossible for them to feed themselves and their families. He's against a minimum wage or controls on the grain market. What then is the solution? The answer, the only possible answer, if you take this position, is charity. Let compassion be shown in action, he writes, the more the better, according to every man's ability. Without all doubt, charity to the poor is a direct and obligatory duty upon all Christians. And it is this charity which he believes has warded off famine. I'm going to read again a passage where there's a bit in it which I don't quite know how to read, but we'll see. Even now, he says, in November of 1895, I do not know of one man, woman, or child that has perished from famine. Fewer, if any, I believe, than in years of plenty, when such a thing may happen by accident. This is owing to a care and superintendence of the poor far greater than any I can remember. Why didn't Smith invoke charity in this Burkean way? The reasons, I think, are obvious. First, Smith's claim was that free market policies would lead to general prosperity. He says, the natural effort of every individual to better his own condition, when suffered to exert itself with freedom and security, is so powerful a principle that it is alone and without any assistance capable of carrying on the society to wealth and prosperity. Burke did not believe in general prosperity. He was prepared to acknowledge that poverty was, as he believed, an irremediable aspect of the human condition. So he could acknowledge the need for charity, where Smith could not. Second, Smith's claim was that the hidden hand, as he called it, ensured that individuals pursuing their own selfish interests served the general good, that there was a natural congruence between market forces and public welfare. His account of how at times of dearth wages are eroded and unemployment is spread simply didn't fit into this story. He makes no mention of it in his optimistic account of how the market has only benevolent consequences in the distribution of grain. He can't afford to address the issue of exchange entitlements without bringing into question the providential scheme which underpins the whole argument of the wealth of nations. The extent to which Smith's whole argument is providential is disputed, but I'm persuaded by those who say it is. He can't face the fact that a benevolent God would not have designed the world in which we find ourselves, where people starve in the midst of plenty. This was no problem for Burke, who believed in original sin, which provided him with a satisfactory explanation. Thirdly, Burke knew that his argument had profound implications for moral philosophy. Pufendorf, he remarked, had not fully grasped the extent of the obligation to charity when he described it as a duty of imperfect obligation. Burke responded by saying that one can take pleasure in the fact that one has control over when, where, how, and to whom one exercises charity, but one is fully obliged to perform acts of charity. It's a duty of perfect obligation. Turn to Smith's Wealth of Nations, and you will find no similar emphasis on an obligation for the better off to come to the assistance of their less fortunate neighbours. When Smith writes about sympathy, he does not mean the sort of sympathy which leads one to share the sufferings of one's neighbours in the theory of moral sentiments. Ferguson said that it was by an abuse of language, that's where I caught this phrase, abuse of language. Ferguson said that it was by an abuse of language that Smith said that he felt sympathy with a man who pays his bills on time. In other words, we approve of him. We think well of him. That's what Smithian sympathy largely is. I'm sure Smith thought well of those who gave money to charitable purposes, but he was far from presenting charity as a perfect obligation. In writing about famine, Smith faced a test. He knew the subject was important, and so he gave it considerable thought. He did a great deal of research. But he failed the test, and he failed it not just in one way, but in four separate and distinct ways. He got his facts wrong. He forgot about Ireland. He got his emotions wrong. He failed to empathize with the suffering. He got his theory wrong. He failed to recognize that a country is not like a ship at sea, because it contains people of widely varied circumstances and conditions. And he got his morality wrong. He failed to consider the obligation to charity. Why? Because he was wedded to a system. To use a phrase he himself was soon to use in the last edition of The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he was, in the end, a man of system. I don't want to go too far in defending Burke, for I've always thought of myself as being on the side of Paine, of Wollstonecraft, and indeed of Smith. I'm rather shocked to find that I have written a lecture in support of Burke. But Burke, for all his faults and failings, had a much better understanding of poverty and famine than Smith did. And this may well have had something to do with the fact that Burke was Irish. He was 11 12, 13 years old during the dreadful hunger years of 1740 to 42, and surely saw the dead and the near dead, just as they're an unspoken, unacknowledged personal experience at the heart of Amartya Sen's great book on famine. So too, there must be the very same experience at the heart of Burke's. Burke had been there. Unlike Smith, he had seen with his own eyes what Galliani describes, the people dying of hunger who can be seen wandering in the streets, spectres, hideous skeletons whose skin is burned red with bleary eyes and limp hair, covered with sores and vermin. You see them approach you with a shuffling gait, asking in a hoarse whisper and with trembling hand for a piece of bread. And sometimes, the moment you try to help them, you see them fall at your feet and die in the dirt.